The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, synthetic drugs. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime hosted its third annual two-day open-ended intergovernmental expert group meeting on the global synthetic drug situation January 20th and 21st. Discussions focused on international integrated responses across four areas: multilateralism, counter-narcotics interventions, early warning, and health responses. Let's get an overview from one of the presenters. Jared Brown is currently the Scientific Affairs Officer, Forensic Early Warning, at UNODC's Laboratory and Scientific Services in Vienna, Austria.
So I'm here to talk to you about kind of early warning from a bit of a different dimension in terms of ensuring that we consider early warning as a very comprehensive early warning system using data from a broad range of sources. So if we can have the slides up, that will help me discuss this from the complex interaction between all the different stakeholders in early warning. So we all very much appreciate the role of laboratory analysis in early warning, and forensic laboratories have been a critical part of early warning for a number of years. But we also need to think about early warning from the broader perspective in terms of the laboratory's limitations in terms of how quickly they can provide a result, and the broader range of data sources that are out there. In this slide, we can see that an example of that broad range of sources in terms of, on the left side, in terms of the list of laboratory analytical data that may be available. But more broadly, we've got a range of stakeholders from different sectors who are collecting different forms of data, which can really help to either identify an initial signal or to investigate that signal to understand it from a triangulated viewpoint, that we do really need to think about the role of using multiple data sources in identifying and or confirming a signal that's been picked up. And we really see that in many of the risk assessment frameworks that countries that have developed that early warning system, that they often would prefer to issue a drug alert, for example, if there are there's more weight on issuing warnings if there's confirmatory data from multiple sources. So the more data that you have access to in a timely manner, the better the science behind making that decision in terms of whether what type of response may be needed and whether a response is warranted. So, for example, kind of the data that exists from hospitals and kind of ambulance data, kind of thinking how that can be used in an early warning system, because that data often gets forgotten in early warning systems in terms of the role that that has, because that might be handled by a different part of the government sector. So really ensuring that we concentrate on a broad range of data sources to help us identify emerging threats, and also working with those the kind of people who are part of those systems, so paramedics, doctors, nurses, harm reduction workers, really ensuring that we're working with them to collect the data and report it in a quality manner, in a timely manner, to be able to act on that data. And also when it comes back to the laboratories who are confirming this data, we might identify a signal in one of these sources. So say there's a sudden increase in opioid overdoses presenting to neighbouring hospitals, that we want to identify what might be causing that. Well, working with the laboratory is important to confirming what the source of that is, to help guide what the specific response might be. But the laboratory in some cases is limited in terms of whether they can give you a result within a day, a week or a month. And so that also influences our the response that can be done. And also they may be able to, even the best labs and who are well-resourced, can kind of identify something within the same day potentially. They might go, well, we think this is a new nitazene, as the example in the video. but they can't confirm it. And so laboratories across the world, traditionally in their forensic capacity, would be very kind of reluctant to share that identification with people outside of the lab because they aren't confident enough to kind of issue a certificate on that analysis yet. But it's still valuable for the early warning system to be aware of that identification early, and it may be able to enact some responses in the intermediate time whilst that preliminary identification is being confirmed, as they may need to order in reference standards or do some additional tests, might need to partner with an academic institution to use more sophisticated equipment to confirm it. So these are some of the things that need to be considered in our early warning systems across the world, that they do rely on a broad range of stakeholders, and it's beyond what we may traditionally think. This next slide is a recent article that was published and provides a framework based on environmental kind of early warning systems. But similarly, there's other examples across infectious diseases as well. But this article has allowed the science of early warning to kind of grow by trying to categorise the different elements of early warning that that are responsible for having effective public health-focused early warning. And some of the key points I've just highlighted out there in the bullet points, although you cannot potentially read some of the figure, but you can also access the reference if you'd like to see the article. But one of the key things that I've pulled out is they do need to draw data from a range of different sources, and they may be, or they are, from a range of different agencies that generally aren't all in the same governance line. So you will need to partner with various agencies. The role of it needing to be kind of close to real time as possible is critical, as the responses are only going to be effective if that substance is still in circulation for you to be able to circumvent the harms that are happening. And as we know, rapidly changing markets means that an issue that's affecting a community for a week or a month may go away within another month or two. So if we're only sharing data on a kind of a extended time frame that doesn't get that information to the right people in a quick enough time, we're missing the boat in terms of being able to act. So that kind of concept of timeliness is critical. The verifiability, so either through laboratory analysis or being able to be verified through multiple different data sources, is another critical concept, which I began with in my presentation. The need to collaborate across multiple different partners. There needs to be a risk assessment process, and where this data is reviewed by an expert group using a framework of risk assessment, and then they need to be able to make decisions in a timely manner that can then enact responses that are going to have real benefits for the community. So that's just a brief introduction into some of those key concepts that we do need to kind of consider. I'll go through some more of the kind of different data sources and some of the examples that have occurred across the world, and the need for kind of international cooperation as well some of the examples that I'll show. So this next slide is just showing kind of, yes, the NPS problem that we have, an ever-growing number of NPS, with the range of different NPS that are being seen in different countries from across the world being depicted in this image. What I wanted to highlight with this is the kind of globally connected market of NPS, and how by sharing this information from one country allows another country to prepare. So the issue with synthetic opioids in falsified medicines is a particular one that we would be aware of. This particular one that I'm highlighting here relates to kind of the nitazene family of synthetic opioids that have been detected across the world. And here's some of these drug alerts or news advisories that have been issued from Europe, from North America, from Australia, just showing the kind of international connectedness of these substances being presented in different forms. So this is falsified medicines, particularly oxycodone tablets. Another one which is affecting different part of the world in terms of in South America and Africa relates to kind of herbal plant material that's been sprayed with nitazenes. And so that's been seen in Brazil, that's been seen in several countries and territories within East Africa, as well as in West Africa, in the form of Kush or Shamik in Africa. And the issue of how these substances may present in different forms, by having the rapid sharing of information, allows us to inform kind of not only kind of from a law enforcement perspective in terms of identifying these substances at the border, for example, or in the community. It's also about kind of health to be, for the health workers to be aware that these substances, if someone comes into the emergency department with some tablets on them, for example, and they've got an unusually severe opioid overdose, for the emergency doctors and nurses to be aware, actually there are fake medicines out there that might not be what's actually in the tablet that it looks like, and to make sure that we're educating our clinicians as well to be aware of these emerging threats. And another one, again, showing kind of international connections, is the recent rise in the vapes containing Etomidate and its analogues, which is an anesthetic agent that is particularly prevalent in multiple countries across Asia and has been kind of spreading kind of from one country to another within Asia. But then more recently within, there's been increasing detections in New Zealand. So again, the international cooperation is critical to be understanding what substances are in circulation, what form that they're in, and also how to identify it. So make sure that we're sharing that kind of analytical methodology that the laboratories require to be able to rapidly identify these substances, and then putting in place the appropriate control mechanisms, be that kind of regulation, be that kind of educational material for the community or for clinicians. There's the broad range of responses that can occur as part of an early warning system. And then this further example here is relating to how kind of within a country the various, this shows an example within Australia where three different states within Australia kind of sharing information to enable the detection of an issue relating to vapes which were thought to be containing cannabis or synthetic cannabinoids, which ended up containing nitazenes, and that the value of the laboratory analysis as part of death investigations, which includes not only testing kind of biological samples, which is kind of quite routine, but testing the kind of the drug samples that come in with the patient, with the deceased, or that the police have seized, because through that provides more intelligence about how that substance got into the person's body. And that might not be part of routine death investigations, but having a system to enable you to go looking further for additional samples to understand what had happened to an individual is an important part of early warning. And then the other example was people presenting in drug withdrawal to hospitals, which was quite a peculiar presentation that had come in after people had been reporting vaping cannabis, and they were saying, well, this doesn't look like this. Having access to the analytical test to enable that is another important way that was able to identify and then communicate those issues that were identified back to clinicians and to the community who are affected to ensure they were aware of it. But it also had a supply reduction response in terms of enabling a successful prosecution against the distribution network by the intelligence that was gained as part of that early warning system investigation, which was initially led by Health.
We're listening to a presentation by Jared Brown, Scientific Affairs Officer, Forensic Early Warning at UNODC's Laboratory and Scientific Services in Vienna, Austria, which he delivered on January 20th at the UNODC Intergovernmental Expert Group meeting on the global synthetic drug situation. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear the rest of that presentation by UNODC's Jared Brown on the current synthetic drug situation.
So I just want to briefly introduce, you'd be likely aware of the early warning advisory, which enables this international cooperation of sharing information. I won't dwell on it particularly long because I imagine most people here would already be aware of it, but there is a platform for that international sharing of information, and that has been the recommendation of multiple different recommendations at C&D and continues to enable that information sharing. That information sharing continues to grow in terms of having a toxicology portal where toxicology data can be shared. The frequency of data that's accessible in the system with investment in data science, enabling more rapid upload of case data and processing of case data. We really encourage more regular submissions, and this is where we're getting to now with having more and more countries who are submitting data on a more regular basis. And in the last couple of years, we've had 107 different countries report data, and concerningly, that involves 743 different NPS. So even in the most recent times, there's still a very broad range of substances that people can encounter. But how do we know which ones we need to concentrate on? And that's what it allows you to do by being able to target which ones are the most prevalent, the most persistent, and the most harmful. This is just to show you the dashboard if you've forgotten what it looks like in terms of an example of what you can get from it. The additional information that you can get from it, and we had the intervention from Ireland pointed out this morning in terms of the value of having scientific data to show the psychoactivity of a substance. We try and incorporate some of the more obscure data that may be either in old patent literature from the 1960s and kind of really pulling that in from scientific publications or pulling that in from the patent literature through our collaborations across the world, as well as using some of the unpublished scientific data that laboratories have contributed to help understand the toxicology or the pharmacology of a substance. And then there is potential, though, to use that data to still generate more new data with some of the information that does get reported to the early warning advisory, and the toxicology portal has that potential. We do have countries that submit data with, in terms of post-mortem toxicology data or hospital toxicology data of people who've come into emergency departments with a drug overdose, of being able to kind of understand what effects are associated with a particular substance is in that data set, and there is potential to use that data more. At the moment, that data requires a bit more of a manual process to review and extract, but we're always working to kind of get smarter using data science techniques to make that information more accessible and more useful for kind of member states to help inform. As we heard, it is used for international kind of regulatory processes by the WHO Expert Committee on Drug Dependence, but also it can be used to inform your own national regulatory decisions by having the data to inform of, again, around the prevalence, persistence and harmfulness of these substances to give you that hard scientific data that that many countries demand to be able to make those decisions in terms of regulations. In the interest of time, I'll just skip over the next couple of slides and just finish up with some points around kind of really understanding how we can use, like who can use early warning data and how it can be used. And it is really, again, a range of different stakeholders that we need to think about how they can use our early warning systems data and how it can be put to the most effective use to reduce the community harms. And so here I just provide some examples for both for laboratories in terms of that information sharing to improve their ability to detect substances, but also for policymakers in terms of which NPS may be more important to control, in terms of for our clinicians and people who use drugs to understand ways to manage patients who might come in withdrawal or with an overdose, or people in terms of harm reduction measures that can be utilised, as well as our research community that is out there that is always looking for work to do. Instead of kind of researchers choosing what to kind of prioritise, they can use this data to understand which NPS they need to really concentrate their research on that will have the most impact, because it is the NPS that are most commonly affecting people in terms of causing toxicity. So just kind of, finishing up there in terms of we need to collaborate more. We need to use lots of different data sources to help better understand what is going on, and sharing that information at multiple levels in terms of including international, and highlighting the role of both drug and biological sample data to really understand what is occurring, but also then the responses need partnerships to ensure that this data is used for the community that we're trying to protect, and to ensure that it has the most beneficial outcomes. And then finally, I just kind of acknowledge the early warning advisory is the product of a lot of different data contributions from a lot of different countries, and that it wouldn't exist without those partnerships and also the funding. And thankfully, we've had a number of countries over the years, but currently the Synthetic Drug Strategy as the key sponsor for the early warning advisory. So thanks, everyone.
That was Jared Brown, Scientific Affairs Officer, Forensic Early Warning at UNODC's Laboratory and Scientific Services in Vienna, Austria, speaking January 20th at the UNODC Intergovernmental Expert Group meeting on the global synthetic drug situation. And finally, I attended a briefing January 21st, quite timely given recent events, that was held by Cyline on the health impacts of tear gas, rubber bullets, and other so-called crowd control weapons. It featured Dr. Rohini Har, an assistant adjunct professor of epidemiology at UC Berkeley Public Health and an emergency physician at Kaiser Medical Center in Oakland, California. We're going to hear a portion of that briefing. The other voice you'll hear in this segment is Sarah Brinda with Cyline.
The top line thing that I would tell you about crowd control weapons, and especially these chemical irritants, is that you calling them less lethal is kind of a misnomer, that the danger and the health risks are really related to how they are used and on whom. And when they're overused or misused, when they target individuals, or when they're used without a need, those harms rapidly escalate. And over 30 plus years of research that we've looked into literature reviews and assessments, these chemical irritants can injure any different part of your body, everything from the tears, obviously in your eyes, to a lot of skin injuries, lung injuries, and mucosal injuries to your mouth, your lungs, things like that. But also those canisters can cause serious harm as well.
Thank you. While we're on that topic of the chemical irritants, can you tell us a little bit? You mentioned, tear gas invented quite a long time ago, but the formulation has changed over time. I saw somewhere that silicon has been added to make it kind of linger longer. What, if anything, is known about the effects of the newer formulations?
So CN gas was one of the original forms of tear gas. Sometimes it's still used in mace spray, if you have that personal protective spray. CS gas has been used for, decades as the primary one. And you're right, there's newer formulations, sometimes called CS1 or CS2, that are silicated. So CS, we call it a gas, but it's actually a powder. And that powder, when it touches the skin or your mucous membranes, it kind of dissolves into the moisture on that body part and activates pain receptors. What we've learned is that the silicated versions, they can last longer because they don't dissipate into the air as easily. And then there's supposed to be more potent versions, CR and CX gas as well. The issue with all of this is that there's almost no regulation of these riot control agents in civilian policing. And so police departments and manufacturers, nobody's really required to say, this is what we're using, this is how much is in a canister, this is how many canisters were fired in this event. So all of that we're trying to capture after the fact. But it's really hard to understand what exactly is in a canister. Of course, it's not just that irritant. There's a lot of other stuff in those canisters
as
well.
Thank you. Next, so we've been talking about the chemical irritants, but there's another category of crowd control agents that you and others have studied that are called kinetic impact projectiles. And this is a group that includes things like rubber bullets, plastic bullets, beanbag rounds, shot pellets. What can you tell us about your research on the effects of these products?
This is a huge range of weapons. It's not only all these different projectiles. I think one of my colleagues counted something like more than 80 different specific projectiles, but also all the weapons that they're fired from. And the fundamental thing to remember is that when they're fired from close range, they can hit as hard as live ammunition and cause serious damage. And because they're not they're not the shape of a bullet, they're often balls or cylinders or other shapes. When they fire from long range, they are very unpredictable in their pattern, and they can injure bystanders or hit people in places that they shouldn't be hit, their face or sensitive body parts. After all these years of research with our entire global group of, you know, academics and advocates and lawyers, we felt that at the end of the day, there is no role for projectiles in crowd control, that they're just not safe. And that was after a lot of debate that we came to that conclusion because of these two issues. Now, I know that they're used all over the world, and it's going to be hard to, you know, have a universal ban of projectiles like rubber bullets. But I would say that there's two parts that are low-hanging fruit that are really dangerous. One is anything with metal in it, like in the U.S. beanbag rounds, which are, you know, synthetic bags with steel pellets inside, or anything with metal component has higher density and is dangerous. You'll see this in Iran right now. There's a lot of concern that they're using birdshot, which is tiny lead or steel pellets that shoot out and are really dense, get embedded in people and cause a lot of fractures, damage, internal injuries. And then the second part is when you fire a single shot, when you pull that trigger once and multiple projectiles come out, between two or three and up to dozens or hundreds. And both of those are really dangerous. All of our data shows that that's where most of the injuries end up. Again, they're dense and you can't aim them, so they can hit children, bystanders, the elderly, they can hit you in the eye, all kinds of things.
That was Dr. Rohini Har, an assistant adjunct professor of epidemiology at UC Berkeley Public Health and an emergency physician at Kaiser Medical Center in Oakland, California. She spoke January 21st on a sideline briefing regarding the health impact of tear gas, rubber bullets, and other so-called crowd control weapons used by police. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug
for
McVeigh.
For the Drug Truth Network,
so
this is Doug
so
McVeigh
long.
Asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.